Well, good morning and welcome. My name is Justin Barnard, and for the past 3 years, I have served as the chair of the Southeast Region of the EPS, and this morning it's my privilege to introduce our plenary speaker. Dr. Paul Copan is Professor and Pledger Family Chair of Philosophy and Ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University in West Palm Beach, Florida. He has a PhD from Marquette University, and in addition to that, he holds degrees from Trinity International University and Columbia International University. He is the author or editor of over 20 books, including Loving Wisdom, Christian Philosophy of Religion, When God Goes to Starbucks, A Guide to Everyday Apologetics, True for You but Not for Me, Overcoming Objections to the Christian Faith, and most recently, Is God a Moral Monster? And since 2006, Paul has served as the president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, and so it really is a privilege to have him here this morning for a regional meeting. On a personal note, I just want to say that as I have gotten to know him, there are two things that have struck me about his character. First, several years ago, I heard him give a paper at a national meeting of the EPS on apologetics, and his focus was on 1 Peter 3:15, which I'm sure will be a familiar verse to many of you who are interested in apologetics, but his particular focus was on a phrase in that verse that's often neglected in apologetic ministry, and that is the phrase, with gentleness and respect. And I know that in his own work and his own ministry as an academic, Paul conducts himself with a spirit of gentleness and respect, and he certainly has an Irenic approach to Christian apologetics, and not what has sometimes been called a sledgehammer approach to Christian apologetics. And secondly, I learned last night, having dinner with him, that he enjoys puns, probably far more than any person should. And so I thought, what more fitting way to introduce someone who loves puns than to introduce him with a limerick? So I came up with this last night. If nothing else, it will convince you that I should keep my day job. It's my effort to capture his career as an apologist and also his Irenic spirit. There is an apologist named Paul who, comparatively speaking, is tall. He stands up for truth without claw or tooth, thus setting an example for all. Will you please join me in welcoming Dr. Paul Copan?
Well, I appreciate that. I've never been introduced with the use of a limerick before. That's a new one. I appreciate that. We are, recently to our Alvin Plantinga came to our campus at Palm Beach Atlantic University, and so we actually did some punning. And Alvin Plantinga mentioned that you're in good company because William Shakespeare was also one who was very good at punning. So I felt justified, at least in the attempt to pun, that I was doing it in the right Shakespeare-it. So maybe there will be a few more of those coming out today. As I like to say, if we're in India, I'd do a Punjabi on you. But since this is philosophical discussion, I didn't want there to be a preponderance of these. So we'll go off the pun track a little bit to talk philosophy here. And my talk today is on ethics and God, and I'll be responding to Wielenberg, Antony, and Sinnott Armstrong. This is part of a book to which I'm contributing with Oxford University Press, debating, the title has changed a few times, debating or Christian theism and dialogue or something like that. J.P. Moreland and Chad Meister are co-editing that. And so in this debate book, we have Christian theists as well as those who are detractors contributing to the book. And so my sparring partner in this is the atheist Louise Antony. But I'll be addressing three naturalistic moral realists in an attempt to show how God and objective morality are necessarily connected. So in my essay, what I am not interested in doing is simply talking about the the existence of objective moral values. That's taken for granted by Antony Wielenberg and Senator Armstrong. And I also am not trying to contend that belief in God is necessary for recognizing moral truths. Properly functioning naturalists, Buddhists, Confucians, and theists know the right thing to do. I'd say that the problem or the confusion comes when we fail to distinguish between epistemology and ontology, and we'll touch on that in a little bit. I also would maintain that atheists or non-theists can live decently and can be kind to others. In fact, some atheists may exhibit a greater moral virtue than professing theists. But what I would like to argue in this presentation is that theism offers a far more likely context than naturalism or non-theism for affirming objective moral values and duties. Naturalism doesn't lead us to expect the emergence of human rights and universal benevolence, a point equally applicable to other non-theistic worldviews. And I think this is important to remember, that when we are talking about the grounding of objective moral values, this doesn't only pertain to kind of a Western-style atheism, but also pertains to non-theistic worldviews, such as Buddhism or Advaita Vedanta Hinduism or something. A lot of Eastern viewpoints, a lot of the critiques that I'm applying here to these Western atheists would also apply to various non-theistic religions as well. Many naturalists themselves, I also argue, observe that that naturalism's context simply cannot lead us to human rights and dignity and moral duties. Also, I argue in this that theism offers a more plausible context than atheism or non-theism for affirming a cluster of features related to human dignity and moral duties. Also, the convergence of contingent human dignity and worth and necessary moral truths makes much more sense on theism than on naturalism. And finally, the typical atheist comeback to connecting God and morality is the Euthyphro dilemma. And so I want to respond to that basically by saying that the Euthyphro objections leave theism unscathed and raise their own problems for the naturalistic or non-theistic moral realists. In general, I'll argue that moral epistemology has to be anchored in the metaphysical resources of theism to provide the most plausible context to account for objective moral values. First, a few preliminaries on naturalistic moral realism. Louise Antony repudiates as mercenary all ethical actions and attitudes motivated by the fear of judgment or reward from God. She says that God is morally superfluous, and that, according to Antony, moral atheism is the true piety. In like manner, the naturalist Erik Wielenberg claims that objective morality's ontological and epistemological foundation consists of certain brute ethical facts. They have no explanations outside of themselves. No further facts make them true. That's the ontological. And we can know these brute ethical facts immediately without inferring them from other known facts. That's the epistemological. Necessary moral truths didn't evolve with humanity, but are part of the furniture of the universe, Wielenberg says. They constitute the ethical background of every possible universe, creating the framework for assessing the actions of any moral agent, whether human or divine. On Wielenberg's non-theistic, non-natural moral realism, in other words, it's not strictly naturalistic, because what Wielenberg argues is that there is, he's becoming transcendental on us here, that there is kind of a Platonic understanding of these moral facts, that they exist in a non-naturalistic setting, they exist independent of nature, and so he uses the term non-theistic, non-naturalistic moral realism. So he says morality cannot be called natural since, like beauty, it supervenes on certain natural properties under certain conditions that is not reducible to these moral properties. So moral value emerges or supervenes when certain conditions are met, but there is also that transcendental realm of these moral facts that exist independent of any human evolution. Now, let me say something about theism in the more natural setting for objective moral values. I think it's important, and I'm often making this case when I'm discussing morality and God with people, that it is, you know, often the naturalists who help us make our best case for the theistic worldview. In fact, I just recently contributed to a book that Mark Linville and David Werther edited, and it's a festschrift for Keith Yandell, published by Continuum Press. And my essay in there is called "The Naturalists Are Declaring the Glory of God." And throughout that, I am quoting naturalists who help to reinforce the point that it is not naturalism, but actually something akin to theism, or theism itself, that offers us the proper resources for accounting for things like consciousness, rationality, free will, or moral responsibility, you know, those types of things. So what I want to do here is point out the same sort of thing, that it's actually naturalists who help us to make a very strong case for the resources of something like theism, rather than naturalism itself, to account for objective moral values and human dignity and so forth. So, Jean-Paul Sartre, for example, says, "It is very distressing that God does not exist, because all possibility of finding values in a heaven of ideas disappears along with him." Friedrich Nietzsche, of course, he says, "There are altogether no moral facts. Indeed, morality has truth only if God is the truth. It stands or falls with faith in God." J.L. Mackey says, "Moral properties constitute so odd a cluster of properties and relations that they are most unlikely to have arisen in the ordinary course of events without an all-powerful God to create them," or I think he means ground them. "Moral values such as human dignity and worth make more sense on theism than naturalism. Why think that value should emerge from valueless material properties?" Muhlenberg claims that no value from valuelessness, that this kind of a maxim is question begging on the theist part. And here he's taking a jab at me and my, I contributed to the book, The Rationality of Theism, on writing on the moral argument. And I said, from valuelessness comes. Well, Muhlenberg, in an essay in Faith and Philosophy, says that this is question begging on the theist part. And his maxim to replace that is, from valuelessness, value sometimes comes. Yet Muhlenberg's maxim is itself terribly question-begging. Just ask, what should we expect if naturalism is true? People like Bertrand Russell and Richard Dawkins give very strong reasons to think that in a world, as Dawkins says, in a world of selfish genes and electrons, there is no good or evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Bertrand Russell talking about this, you know, this platform of, you know, the scaffolding of unyielding despair, that this is really the habitation on which, this is the foundation on which the soul's habitation may safely be built. Well, there is no, you know, if we're just accidental collocations of atoms, then why think that value should emerge given this kind of a context? And remember, Nietzsche, Sartre, Mackey are just a few fish in the larger naturalistic pond who recognize naturalism's inability to generate objective moral values, such as universal benevolence and human rights. Theism, on the other hand, has no such problems. As we'll see, the same applies to consciousness, rationality, and free will or personal responsibility. Naturalism itself leads us to question similar question-begging maxims, such as, from non-conscious matter, consciousness sometimes comes, or from deterministic processes, free will sometimes comes, or from non-rational matter, rationality sometimes comes. We could also talk about the beginning of the universe, from nothing, something may sometimes come, you know, but we won't go there. But the worldview favoring a robust moral world is theism, in which a good, rational, supremely aware creator makes human beings in his image. God's existence secures the existence of genuine value and rights in a contingent world, easily accounting for human dignity, rights, moral responsibility, which includes rationality and free will, and duties. On naturalism, however, why think that morally responsible, valuable beings, that they would be the product of mindless, non-rational, physical, valueless, non-conscious processes? Unlike theism, naturalism's context can't anticipate the emergence of value. A personal creator who makes human persons in the creator's image serves as the ontological basis for the existence of objective moral values, moral obligation, human dignity, and rights. Consider, first of all, that without the existence of a personal God, no persons would exist at all. That God is the sufficient reason for the existence of anything rather than nothing at all. And, secondly, if no persons would exist, then no moral properties would be instantiated or realized in our world. Without this personal creator or creator of other persons, why think moral properties would be instantiated? Moral values, the instantiation of moral properties, and personhood are intertwined. Moral properties are instantiated through personhood, which is ontologically rooted in God's personhood. Again, if naturalism is true and the universe is inherently meaningless, we simply should not expect human dignity and rights to emerge. Surely intellectual honesty forces us to admit that human rights and universal benevolence more naturally or more fittingly flow from a theistic universe than a naturalistic one. Another point here, theism's naturalness versus naturalism's shocking cosmic coincidences. If such naturalists as Antony and Walter Sinnott Armstrong, who talks about free will and human beings having rights and so forth, and Eric Weilenberg, if they reject that humans are nothing more than accidental collocations of atoms or molecules in motion, the context problem still persists. Consider the following reasons. First, a theistic context for human dignity and rights is far more natural, as we've already seen, and is expected, rather than on a non-theistic view in which valueless molecules produce value. To say that value sometimes may emerge from valuelessness, as Weilenberg argues, reflects an ungrounded metaphysical optimism. Secondly, the naturalistic moral scenario is indeed shocking, a shocking coincidence, unlike the natural connection between a personal good God's existence and that of morally valuable creatures. Let's assume, for example, that moral facts are necessarily part of the universe's furniture, and that beings like us luckily evolved via a torturous, profoundly contingent series of unguided physical events to be morally constituted and thus obligated to those pre-existing facts. It is strange in excelsis and staggeringly coincidental that these moral facts should first just exist, and secondly, perfectly correspond to intrinsically valuable beings that happen to emerge so late on the cosmic scene. These moral facts were somehow anticipating moral creatures that would evolve and be duty-bound to them. Theism, by contrast, does not lean on such weak metaphysical reads. Rather, it brings together unproblematically two otherwise unconnected features, moral facts rooted in a divine necessary being's personhood, and moral creatures in whose image they have been made. Third, objective moral values supervening upon naturalistically evolved, neurologically sophisticated organisms presents a problem for the naturalist. Namely, why think that our moral awareness and development reflects those pre-existent moral facts? After all, we could have emerged and evolved in a completely different direction. We could have evolved a contrary morality that would have enhanced survival and reproduction. Michael Ruse, for example, offers this counterfactual. He said instead of evolving from savanna-dwelling primates, we, like termites, could have evolved needing to dwell in darkness, eat each other's feces, and cannibalize the dead. If the latter were the case, we would extol such acts as beautiful and moral and find it morally disgusting to live in the open air, dispose of body waste, and bury the dead. Michael Shermer affirms, another atheist, agnostic, affirms that our remote ancestors have genetically passed on to us our sense of moral obligations within, and this is epigenetically reinforced by group pressure. So ultimately, to ask why should we be moral is like asking why should we be hungry or horny. Yet C.S. Lewis earlier observed that on naturalism, moral impulses are no more true or false than a vomit or a yawn. Thinking I ought is on the same level as I itch. Indeed, Lewis said, my impulse to serve posterity is just the same sort of thing as my fondness for cheese or preferring mild or bitter beer. Naturalism's inability to get beyond descriptions of human behavior and psychology, the is, does not inspire confidence for grounding moral obligation or ought. At best, one should remain tentative about it, although Antony and Wielenberg and Senator Armstrong somehow confidently pushed past such moral tentativity. Atheistic moral realists naively think that they can escape Ruse's point that our sense of right and wrong and feeling of obligation to be thus governed is of biological worth, serves as an aid to survival and has no being beyond this. What if our belief in moral duties is a corporate illusion fobbed off on us by our genes to get us to cooperate, as Ruse says? The philosopher Eliot Sober rejects the purported claim that ethical beliefs can't be true if they're the product of naturalistic evolution, which commits both, he says, the genetic and naturalistic fallacies. Those are like instead of the Sadducees, we've got the fallacies here. So, but they commit the genetic and naturalistic fallacies. That is, it's possible that even if one's beliefs are produced by non-rational mechanisms, this doesn't entail their falsity. True enough. But Sober misses the bigger point. If our beliefs are accidentally true, being pumped into us by physical and social forces beyond our control, they still do not qualify as knowledge or warranted true belief. And we may hold false beliefs that help us to survive as a species. For example, we may believe in human intrinsic dignity and worth and rights and so forth, when we don't actually possess them, but these false beliefs would enhance survival and reproduction. So naturalism's context doesn't inspire confidence in the emergence of objective moral values, the actual existence of human dignity, duty, and rights, however strongly we are wired to believe it, or thirdly, in the trustworthiness of our belief-forming structures, since naturalistic evolution is interested in survival rather than truth. Let me say something now about theism and the requisite features for moral beings. Naturalistic moral realists, such as Senator Armstrong, Antony, and Wielenberg, acknowledge that humans are accidental, evolved, mortal, and relatively short-lived. That's a quotation from Wielenberg. But they claim that this, by itself, does not present the total moral picture. This, incidentally, is precisely the picture that I've made, namely that the emergence of human rights and moral values is non-questioned, beggingly anticipated by theism, but not naturalism. But anyway, such naturalistic thinkers commonly point to three key features or subvening properties on which human dignity and rights emerge. Walter Sinnott Armstrong argues for freedom or free will as being what grounds human rights and what grounds our dignity and worth. The capability of discerning right and wrong and using reason to do so is something that that Antony emphasizes, and also the capacity for self-awareness and self-consciousness, which both Wielenberg and Antony emphasize. A major criticism, however, of naturalistic moral realists is this insouciant and gratuitous assumption that moral values just emerged via supervenience on natural or non-moral properties, such as a sufficiently developed brain and nervous system. The result, well, that somehow these beings that are neurologically sophisticated are morally valuable, duty-bound, and rights-bearing human beings. David Brink, a while ago in his defense of moral realism as an atheist, says, assuming materialism is true, mental states supervene on physical states, yet few think that mental states are metaphysically queer. So if the mental supervenience on the physical is such a naturalistic slam dunk, then why not objective moral values? Many non-theists simply fail to take seriously just how gratuitive such assumptions are. Why think matter and energy, which lack inherent meaning and purpose, could come close to producing rights-bearing, valuable beings? Theism has no such troubles as we've seen, just the opposite, as we continue to note. There is this remarkable irony in what we've seen, that these aforementioned naturalistic moral realists claim that one or perhaps some combination of these features is sufficient to ground human dignity and worth, the capacity for self-awareness, self-consciousness, or reason, and free will. Yet, other naturalists quite convincingly argue that naturalism cannot account for these very features on which the naturalistic moral realist hangs her hopes. So let's explore those briefly. First, self-awareness and consciousness. Moral beings have the capacity of self-awareness, rising above genetics and environment, to consider intentions, varying motivations, and perspective choices. Yet naturalistic philosophers of mind acknowledge that the emergence of self-consciousness from non-conscious matter is a huge problem. Colin McGinn, he says, we know that brains are the de facto causal basis of consciousness, but we have, it seems, no understanding of how this can be so. It strikes us as miraculous, eerie, even faintly comic. Jeffrey Maddow, he says that the emergence of consciousness then is a mystery, and one to which materialism signally fails to provide an answer. David Papineau, as to why consciousness emerges in certain states, or in certain cases, he says, to this question, physicalists' theories of consciousness seem to provide no answer. In contrast to theism, which affirms a supremely self-aware being, naturalism's resources have no predictable room for consciousness or self-consciousness. So there's strike one. Secondly, reason or rationality. Moral beings have the capacity to take and reflect on alternative moral paths and make moral judgments. While the emergence of creaturely rationality in the context of a rational God makes sense, naturalistic evolution, by contrast, is interested in survival, not truth. That is, we may form false survival-enhancing beliefs, such as humans are morally responsible or humans have rights, a phenomenon which naturalists commonly acknowledge. So Patricia Churchland, for example, says, boiled down to its essentials, a nervous system enables the organism to succeed in the four Fs, fighting, fleeing, feeding, and reproducing. Truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost. Richard Rorty says that truth is un-Darwinian. Again, Michael Ruse talks about morality as being a corporate illusion. James Rachels says that man is a moral altruistic being, not because he intuits the rightness of loving his neighbor, because he responds to some noble ideal, but because his behavior is comprised of tendencies which natural selection has favored. So we are left wondering, why should we trust our minds whose thoughts are the result of mindless molecules affecting other mindless molecules? How has Ruse escaped this corporate illusionism to which all the rest of us are subject? In fact, I asked this to Richard Dawkins himself in South Florida when he was speaking at Nova Southeastern University. He spoke on the fact of evolution, and during the Q&A time I was up first one at the microphone, and I asked him, I said, in your book River Out of Eden, you say that we are simply dancing to the music of our DNA. And so my question is, how on that view is the naturalist more rational than the theist? Because we are simply dancing to our DNA, and we are believing things over which we have absolutely no control. So Richard Dawkins says, well, I guess it's because science works. And he went on to talk about how Republicans and Democrats have their views. They think they're right on these issues. And then he concluded by this rhetorical flourish, saying that, besides, science flies rockets to the moon, but religion flies planes into buildings. And this place, 2,000 people just erupted in applause as though I had just gotten taken to the woodshed. But of course, Richard Dawkins himself was simply dancing to the music of his DNA. Those terrorists were dancing to the music of their DNA. He didn't answer the question at all. In fact, he was Dawkins the issue. So again, it illustrates why should we trust our noetic structure if we have no reason to take these non-rational processes as leading to truth on a regular basis. But if we've been created by a rational being, we've been designed to trust our faculties, moral, rational, perceptual, and constantly failing to trust them is a sign of cognitive malfunction. It would be wrong-headed to abandon them. So when it comes to naturalism, why should Wielenberg and Anthony and Sinnott Armstrong adopt, say, human dignity and rights over the views of Ruse or Rorty, whose naturalistic evolutionism entails truth being incidental to survival? Naturalism doesn't inspire confidence here. So we have kind of a strike two when it comes to grounding human worth and dignity. Thirdly, the capacity of free will. Naturalistic moral realists commonly claim that human processes, moral responsibility, or free will, humans possess moral responsibility and free will, having risen above the genetic determinism of our evolutionary predecessors. Again, this intuition of free will, however strong, is an illusion, according to other naturalists. We've already seen what Michael Ruse had to say. William Provine, who is taught at Cornell University, has said that free will as traditionally conceived, the freedom to make uncoerced and unpredictable choices among alternative courses of action, simply does not exist. There is no way the evolutionary process as currently conceived can produce a being that is truly free to make choices. Francis Crick, another atheist, biologist, has said that our sense of identity and free will are nothing more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. And of course, if Crick was right, then his own comments were nothing more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Thomas Nagel, he says there is no room for agency in a world of neural impulses, chemical reactions, and bone and muscle movements. John Searle, he says we believe we could have done something else, and that human freedom is just a fact of experience. However, the scientific approach requires that this notion of the self that could potentially interfere with the whole causal of nature is simply false, that science undermines that intuition. John Bishop, he says, our scientific understanding of human behavior seems to be in tension with a presupposition of the ethical stance we adopt toward it. So the necessary metaphysical requirements for moral beings, self-consciousness, rationality, free will, and moral responsibility are undermined by a naturalistic context. That non-conscious matter directed by non-rational, deterministic, and valueless processes cannot produce the kind of results that these optimistic moral realists hope it will. Value cannot emerge. Self-consciousness, rationality, and free will cannot emerge in this naturalistic universe. What's more, our natural history from the Big Bang to the bacterium to Homo sapiens is that this whole process. You know, we ought to question whether value could emerge from such valueless beginnings. That we see that there is no predictable hope for giving rise to valuable rights-bearing beings. A universe, as we've seen by Dawkins, of electrons and selfish genes has no metaphysical wherewithal to produce beings possessing intrinsic dignity and worth. Yet these naturalistic moral realists we've been discussing, wishful thinkers all, latch on to a theistically grounded human dignity and moral freedom, which, of course, is certainly understandable, because they, as atheists, have been made in the same image that believers have, namely the image of God. Yet their context leaves us with no metaphysical shred of confidence that value will or could be produced. Let me just briefly say something about the Euthyphro question. Plato's Euthyphro dialogue raises the question, is what is holy holy because the gods approve it, or do they approve it because it is holy? In theistic terms, either God's commands are arbitrary, something is good because God commands it, and he could have commanded the opposite, or there must be some autonomous moral standard which God consults in order to command. And given the abundance of literature rebutting such a notion, it's no mild shock that Antony takes this as an explicit and vivid dilemma from which there is no escape. So she is just kind of anchoring her belief in objective moral values in some sort of an independent standard, that there's got to be some sort of independent standard of God, and that the Euthyphro argument in Plato's dialogue establishes this very clearly. So she talks about this being explicit and vivid, a dilemma. The theist easily evades this false dilemma. There is a third way. Goodness is non-arbitrarily rooted in God's necessarily good personhood or character, not in divine commands themselves. Antony's mistaken assumption that good equals commanded by God, and therefore God could issue entirely opposite commands, is indeed strange. Unlike humans, God does not have duties to follow, nor does he need them. Rather, God naturally does what is good because his character is good, loving, and just. Thus, it would be strange that God would have duties or be obligated to his own divine commands, particularly when God's personhood is the very source of goodness. Antony incorrectly assumes that William of Ockham's version of the divine command theory is the only game in town, that God could command, say, torturing babies for fun, and this would become obligatory. Yet to say that there is no good or bad except what God commands, as Antony does, is a gross distortion. While God's commands are relevant to ethics, they do not define or constitute goodness. For instance, God may give commands, say kosher or planting laws for national Israel, that are not permanently binding, nor is there any reason to think that these are inherently good. What's more, we've seen earlier that the horns of the dilemma are not exhaustive. For example, we could talk instead of God's commanding something because it is good, or vice versa, we can speak of God's commanding because he loves us, and because he is concerned about maximizing human well-being in relation to who God is. Moreover, for God to command something like torture or rape goes against the very foundation of God's nature. To ask, what if God were to command rape or baby torture, would be like saying, what if God could make a square circle? Or what if God could create a married bachelor? True, our moral intuitions are not infallible. And even if we get the basics right, they may still stand in need of correction. And a wise, all-good God may on occasion, or in dire conditions, command something jarring. For example, for Abraham to offer up Isaac, which means that he will have morally sufficient reasons for doing so. To test Abraham's faith, that God will show himself trustworthy to fulfill his promise, even if it means raising Isaac from the dead and so forth. But that said, we do have certain unshakable intuitions that it is always wrong to rape or torture babies for fun. So it would be self-contradictory that a necessarily good God would command such things. Strangely, Antony's writings do not address what seems a most obvious response to Euthyphro. All humans have been endowed with value by God. That's the ontological. And thus have the capacity to know what is good. That's the epistemological. So God's commands, far from being arbitrary, are in accordance with God's necessarily good personhood. And when God acts, he simply does what is right. We humans would not know goodness, epistemology, without God's granting us a moral constitution, including rights, reason, and free will. Here's the ontology. More can be said about the Euthyphro, and I'll just mention a couple things. Now, I'm supposed to go till what time?
10:30
is the limit. Okay. Let me just give a couple bullet points here. Well, actually, I think I probably... Let me just a couple of bullet points here. If there is some sort of a standard outside of God, we're left wondering, you know, if that's indeed the case, that God somehow needs to consult some standard outside of God. Well, what is it that makes that standard good? Maybe isn't there some other standard that would be required? And I'd say in the name of simplicity, God's character sufficiently anchors that moral standard, that God is that moral standard, so we don't need to appeal to anything outside. In fact, that is indeed the simpler explanation. And the whole idea of the Euthyphro does not even address how humans came to have dignity and worth. So that is a completely separate question from how humans could arise with, you know, having intrinsic dignity and worth. Let me just say this in closing, then we'll take questions. The Euthyphro dilemma poses no threat to a theistically rooted ethic. In fact, we could launch a similar critique against the naturalists' own moral standard that exists independently of God. Why should we take that as being the ultimate standard? Maybe there's some sort of other standard that we need to confer with or consult with beyond that standard that they're claiming. What makes that good standard good? One final point. The naturalistically explicable impulse of self-sacrifice for one's own offspring or even species makes no rational sense, a sharp contrast to the theistic worldview. On naturalism, why should a person surrender his momentary existence, all the existence he will ever have, so that his offspring may survive? Or why endure lifelong imprisonment in a communist jail cell for refusing to reveal the whereabouts of an innocent who is an enemy of the state? Accounting for such self-sacrificial acts or virtuous acts that bring lifelong hardship and anguish or even death is problematic for naturalistic moral realists. On the other hand, theism assures us that God does not demand of us more than we can bear, and that God will guarantee that a morally virtuous life and even self-sacrifice are not in vain if one's trust is in God. In this case, God's existence guarantees or secures that the moral life and happiness will ultimately come together, something that naturalism cannot guarantee. Naturalists must concede that on their view, virtue will frequently go unrewarded, and that the unjust and wicked will frequently get away with murder. By contrast, the true believer is motivated by dedication to a personal being, not to some mere abstract facts and duties. Ultimate happiness is not found in some crass material or hedonistic reward, as critics like Antony commonly charge, but in the enjoyment of the company of the God whom the believer has served and in whose personhood is the very standard of goodness. Thus, the believer can and should be good for goodness' sake. That is, to pursue virtue for its own sake, since God's personhood itself is the fount of goodness. And God is also the guarantor that life rightly lived will not in the final day be ignored. Atheism is not the true piety. Thank you. All right, some questions here. Yes.
I enjoyed your paper and definitely on board with all of it. But what do you say to an atheist who makes the following claim? And I think this is a kind of trying to push the burden off them, but I'm not sure how to make the move back. I'll have atheists in my department who hold objective moral values, and they'll just say, look, they're just primitives. Mm-hmm. Hey, this is how we do philosophy. You have to start somewhere, and these are primitives. Mm-hmm. So in essence, they're trying to say, look, I know you have this theological explanation for your objective values, but I just don't need them. That's what I start with. What sort of thing would you say to something like that?
Well, I would say it's a great question. And this is again a common objection. Louise Antony and others would certainly concur. I think the first line of defense is not so much to talk about the in a sense the metaphysical and the ontological aspects of how how these moral facts could be grounded in God. I would say these primitives are one point, and we could debate that, but what makes what these primitives assume is the intrinsic value and dignity of human beings, for which I see absolutely no metaphysical grounding whatsoever. Why think that humans would have value? Why think that they would have dignity and worth? In my doctoral dissertation, I responded to the moral dimensions of Michael Martin's atheology, and one of his arguments was that he said that theists and atheists will give the same reasons for why rape is wrong. It violates the victim's rights, it traumatizes the victim, it tears apart the fabric of society. All true. But notice what he is assuming here. He is assuming that the rape victim has dignity and worth, that this rape victim has rights that ought not to be violated. Again, on naturalism, why think that there should be any kind of inherent dignity and worth that should not be violated? I mean, in fact, there are, Randy Thornhill and Craig Thornhill and Randy Palmer, anthropologist and biologist, in their book A Natural History of Rape, actually argue that from a naturalistic point of view, rape is biologically explicable because it enhances reproduction and survival. For example, when a male can't find a mate, he, because of this subconscious drive to survive and reproduce, forces himself upon a female, thus enhancing the chances for survival through those sorts of acts. And again, this is something, if it's natural, then again, why would we argue against that? It's grounded in the naturalistic world. I'd say you're going to have to appeal to something transcendent in order to claim that person has dignity and worth. I mean, this act akin to rape are done in the animal world. Why would this be? You see animals devouring their young and so forth. Why should that be different when a mother, say, drowns her children in a bathtub? So I would go there. What worldview better anchors intrinsic dignity and worth and so forth? And I'd also argue that historically speaking, it has been the Christian faith, the biblical faith, that has given rise to our human rights talk. For example, it was Christians in conferring with Jewish rabbis that actually gave rise to the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. It was not the secularist. We even go back further to the Declaration of Independence that these rights are grounded in this creator. And that goes even back further to medieval philosophy, which talks about certain natural rights and so forth. So we can talk about those sorts of things and the history that is there. We're going to talk about the bioethics movement, which is actually was inspired by in the mid '60s people like Daniel Callahan and others who actually stepped forward and wanted to deal with human personhood in light of advancing technology. It was Christians at the forefront of these charges. So not only metaphysically, but actually historically, you see that working out in how Christians have been at the forefront of, it's not an Enlightenment value. This has actually been anchored in something far deeper. So that's the direction which I would go. Yeah. Yes?
When it comes to the brute facts of just existing, could the argument be forwarded that they are arbitrary, that these values that you have chosen are arbitrary, and that it could just as well be that the universe is populated with forms, Platonic forms like greed and rapacity and cruelty? And how do we know that that altruism exists and that these other forms are not out there? Would that be I've heard of William Lane Craig advance that. Would you concur with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is certainly one thing that could be advanced. I mean, after all, what Michael Ruse said about these, if we've evolved from savannah-dwelling primates, that we've developed in one scenario, but we would be convinced otherwise if we developed from termites, say. And so we would have a completely different set of values. And so it's kind of like what, I was at a conference with Daniel Dennett. I presented a paper on some of these things, and Daniel Dennett got up and he said, well, the moral configuration that we have, he said, I'm a moral realist, well, he's not really, but he said, it's kind of like we develop rules for chess. And that just becomes, in a sense, the essence of what chess is. We just have these sorts of rules. But he said, there's a Milton Bradley game I grew up with this, a game called SMES. And it had, all sorts of, ninnies and so forth. Instead of bishops and rooks, it had ninnies and so forth that were part of this game. And it had completely different kinds of moves. You had to learn these separate moves. And he said, we could have developed into smess-like beings rather than chess-like beings. And so he said, it's just kind of the luck of the draw. And I'd say, and we would have been just as convinced if things were different for us. And I'd say that is exactly what Michael Ruse is pointing out, that this is a corporate illusion fobbed off on us, on our genes, to get us to cooperate. If we are simply stuck with, in a sense, nature, why think that what is what ought to be? Because there are a lot of things that that the way that things are could actually enhance survival and reproduction, and maybe we're pushing too hard that rape is intrinsically wrong, because after all this could enhance survival and reproduction. Maybe we need to rethink that whole rape issue. In fact, people are doing that with, say, pedophilia. That's no longer a diagnostic disorder and so forth. Well, what about that? Should we take other things off the list as well? So I would say, yeah, you're right to bring up that that question. But I think even more fundamentally, the issue of human dignity and worth just has no grounding given the resources of naturalism. Yeah, yeah. I think this will be the final question here.
Kind of a counter move to the brute facts of more values and obligations. What do you think about endeavoring to kind of show transcendental preconditions to make moral values and obligations intelligible, kind of going that route?
Well, I'd argue that too. In fact, I wasn't able to get around to it, but I would say that there is a certain asymmetry that even if there are necessary truths, for example, we can talk about consciousness being necessary. That is, in all possible worlds, God exists, so therefore consciousness is necessary. We also talk about morality being, we talk about certain moral truths that are being necessary. Why? Because they're anchored in the good, the good character of God. And so we can talk about certain, certain fundamental, metaphysical truths that are necessary, again, rooted in the mind of God, and that there are certain entailments that come from those necessary truths. But they are secondary, and we can talk about these, we can talk about certain moral truths as being kind of secondary, being anchored in something far more fundamental. And so you can talk about certain things that exist, you know, like triangularity and so forth. Or, but there are certain entailments that come from, say, triangularity that are not necessarily anchored in the concept of triangularity itself. So, you know, or certain configurations of numbers or whatever. There may be certain fundamental, certain basics metaphysically from which there are, in a sense, necessary entailments, but there are more fundamental ones from which anchor them. And so we can talk about God being that anchor point from which there are certain things that are that spring from them. So there's a certain asymmetry, metaphysically speaking. So we could go in that route too. Yeah. Anyway, we're out of time, but thanks very much.